I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Steve Burgess joins me again. He's written a terrific new book, Cheapskate in Lotus Land, The Philosophy and Practice of Living Well on a Small Budget. It looks at how we all view money and how we spend it. Some of us are spendthrifts while admitting to wanting to be thriftier. Our habits are changing because of the inflation around us, but not quickly enough, certainly not as fast as Steve, who seems to be ahead of a lot of this. He does some research in the book as to consumerism and our reaction to it. He's looked at the prices of things like food and how manufacturers, as well as grocery outlets throughout the country, make their money off of us. Steve has lived well in his over three decades in Vancouver without making a lot, and the book provides marvelous insight into how he's lived, and sometimes it's amusing, but there's a lot of wisdom too. The hope as one reads the book is that readers will glean some practical advice that just might give us a little more financial security, and we certainly could use some nowadays. Steve Burgess is a writer and broadcaster who has received two Canadian National Magazine Awards. He's a contributing editor at the TIE and an award-winning documentary director. His previous books include Reservations, The Pleasures and Perils of Travel, which was longlisted for the Leacock Medal, and Who Killed Mom? His work has appeared in such publications as Reader's Digest, Maclean's, and the Globe and Mail. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. We spoke nearly 2 weeks ago. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Steve Burgess. Mr. Burgess, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Pleased to be talking to you again.
Nice to talk to you. I can't say how much I enjoyed the book. I laughed out loud numerous times. What is it like, before we get into what the book's about, as a writer? I mean, are you a fast writer?
I am a fast writer, actually. I mean, it seems kind of boastful, but talking to other writers and talking to editors and everything, I guess I'm probably faster than most. This book actually, yeah, kind of came in record time. I had I got the deal to do this book from Harbor and Douglas and McIntyre in September, and I had a manuscript in by February. And then I ended up adding another chapter about Trump's tariffs.
Yeah.
There's a chapter on that. That I wrote that a little later, but I had my first draft in by February. So I'm pretty fast.
Because the reason I bring that up is because as I'm reading the book and I reread parts of it this weekend in preparing for our chat today, it comes across as even though there are times over the essays in the book that are heavily researched. Where you have interviewed people, it comes across as conversational. And I think that's the thing I've loved about your writing over the years, is that I can hear your voice, if you will.
Yeah, I've had people say that to me, and I consider it a real compliment. But people have said after they met me that I talk the way I write, and I certainly consider that a compliment.
Yeah. I think a lot of people conflate being frugal with being miserly, and I guess
right.
After reading the book, they're not the same, are they?
No, they're really not. And I think one of the key differences. I mean, being a miser is often about greed, and wanting more and never being satisfied. Whereas being frugal is about making the most of your resources. And as I say in the book, I think that being frugal is the necessary virtue of people who decide to follow their passions rather than chasing money. People who chase money are naturally always going to want more and more. But if you decide that you would rather do what you really want to do for a living, well, that's rarely lucrative. You're lucky if it becomes lucrative, but for the most part, it isn't lucrative. And so that means that if you decide that you're going to follow your passions, you're probably going to have to learn how to get discount cheese, you know?
Mm.
So you're going to have to learn how to be frugal.
Now, your own frugality, that didn't come from childhood, or maybe did it? I mean, I looked at the book here, and you're not old enough to have grown up in the Depression, but maybe your parents did. Did that have anything to do with it, say?
Well, whether I got it from my parents, like, directly, the thing is, we didn't have a lot of money when I was young, that's for sure, because my dad was working for the United Church and eventually became, you know, United Church minister. But he did not. We didn't have a lot of money. And eventually, my mom went back to school and got her teaching certificate and started a teaching career. And our financial circumstances improved quite a bit. But when we were young, you know, five kids within 6 years on a United Church worker's salary, we did not have money. And so, like, if we got a dime, it was a big deal. If the kids were given a dime on a special occasion.
Yeah.
And I remember my allowance was, I think it was 2 cents for a while. So absolutely the frugality came out of necessity. Whether or not it was ingrained, I don't know. I suspect it is. I suspect that some aspects of our personality really, you know, come with the package. And I know that I've always been, for good and for ill, I've always been somewhat obsessive. And so when it comes to doing anything, I tend to do it with a somewhat obsessive tinge sometimes, you know, well, often to a fault. And that happens with frugality as well. I've recognized sometimes to my chagrin that my frugality has to do with an obsessive nature, which I've always had. So yeah, I think it's always been there, really.
Before I get any further, talking about your family just now, it reminded me of the story in the book about your grandmother. I think it's your mom's mom.
Mm-hmm.
I laughed out loud about the story about, if her kids sent her gifts,
yes,
and they were late, she would send them back unopened.
Yes.
Where did that come from?
Well, it came from my grandmother. Like, I mean, she was, I don't know, I don't think that had anything to do with the Depression or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I think that was just my grandmother was a mean piece of work. My grandmother was, you know, pardon me, she's long gone, and I would probably have said this about her when she was alive, though. She really was a nasty bit of business.
Mm-hmm. So we live in Vancouver. I mean, the book is called, you know, Cheapskate and Lotusland. So you've given us the setting. I know a lot of people who are cheap, who are frugal, but they like mm-hmm. to hide it. And I don't know if that's because we live here. There's so many social, I guess, expectations, or maybe I'm just in the wrong social circles. Is that something that you've seen too, living in Vancouver?
I don't think it's just a Vancouver thing. I think it's endemic. I mean, I think that a lot of people are ashamed, you know, fake it till you make it and all that. Mm. There's this idea that you splash out, that you show big, you know, and then, even if it's a false front, you know, the idea that you try to make yourself look prosperous, that's kind of baked into the culture, you know? I mean, it's advice even that young people get, you know, make yourself look prosperous, look the part, yeah. You know? And I think that the idea of being frugal is, it speaks to many people associate it with poverty and you say what you like. I mean, even though, you know, poverty is considered a religious virtue, there are very few parts of our society that prize poverty. Everybody wants to avoid the appearance of it. So, no, I think the idea of frugality being shameful is something that isn't just Vancouver. I think it's, I remember when I was young, my sister used to refer to public transit as the loser cruiser.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think I think there's a real shame attached to not just to frugality, but to the necessity for frugality. The idea that you can't afford things. I think that embracing the virtues of frugality, I think is a good thing. I mean, for one thing, when you embrace the virtue of frugality, one thing that you're also doing is you're saying no to waste.
Yeah.
And there's such a tremendous amount of waste that goes on in our society. And the amount of food waste in particular
mm-hmm.
is criminal. It's obscene. And if you say to yourself, I'm not going to waste food, maybe you're doing it for practical reasons. Maybe you're saying, I'm not going to waste food because I can't afford to.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's beneficial for everybody. If you don't waste, everybody benefits.
Indeed.
Maybe the people who are trying to sell you more food, I guess.
One of the things to admire about the way you look at life in general, unlike, say, the spendthrift, you see money as finite, which probably makes you one of those people who don't have to rely on credit. I mean, I read in the book you were 40 when you first got a credit card. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I only got a credit card because I realized that when I really developed a love for international travel, which is, among other things, it's expensive.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, I realized you really can't do that without a credit card. And so then I got one, but then I just made an absolute point that I will always pay off my balance every month, so I'm not paying interest charges. But no, I didn't get a credit card till I was 40. I was afraid of having access to unlimited credit, and that again goes back when I mentioned that my frugality has to do somewhat with an obsessive nature. I was afraid of that obsessive nature, and I realized that obsessive nature could go in several directions, many of them not good. And so I was afraid that I wasn't even always conscious of it, but I gradually became conscious of the fact that I had a fear that if I had a credit card, I'd go crazy, and spend myself into debt. So, by the time I was 40, I think I had my buttons in a row and I was mature enough, and I realized, okay, you know what your financial principles are, you know how you want to conduct yourself, and you are going to pay off your balance every month and make sure you're not wasting money on interest charges, which, I mean, of all the things you can do with your money,
mm-hmm.
credit card interest charges, you might as well just, roast your money over an open flame. It's just pointless.
This obsessive nature also applies to a phobia of running out of food too, right?
Yes, it does. Yeah. It does. Yeah, yeah. If there's something that I really really like and then it goes on sale, it's just like I have to stock up to a fault. I mean, you don't want, obviously, as I say, you don't want waste, and you got to make sure that you're not going to buy something that's going to go absolutely stale. But I've been guilty of that on occasion, I'm afraid.
Yeah. So as a shopper, you're quite savvy, as we read in the book, that as you're going up and down the aisle of the supermarket in your neighborhood there, you're paying attention to the flyers. I guess we don't get flyers anymore delivered to our house. So you're actually standing outside looking at the flyers that are posted in the glass there?
Well, what I do first, I check them online.
Ah, I see. Yeah.
Check them online, and then I'll sometimes double check the ones that are, just to remind myself. If I saw something interesting in the flyer online, and then I'll look at the one outside the store to remind myself, oh, yeah, that's a good deal here, and that's a good deal there. The flyers can be a little bit disappointing these days, though, because they get padded out with regular priced items.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's stupid. I get angry, though. I'm looking at the flyer on my computer screen, and I'm talking back to it. I go, what's that doing in there? What are you sticking that in there? That's for $5. It's always $5. It's $5 every week. Why are you bragging about it? but then you just look for the outliers. You look for the few things that you need. You don't want to be getting deals on things you don't want or don't need.
Yeah.
But you're just looking for the outliers, the things that are staples for you and are on sale this week.
So our dollars aren't going up as far as we'd like. How are you faring in this time where the price of groceries is quite high?
Well, I'm having to get over the fact that, what happens is you get used to a certain price point for something, and then if the price goes above that, you think, well, I'm not paying that.
Yeah.
It's too much. And eventually you have to realize, well, you know what? The price on this item, this product, has reset. and I need to accept that. Mm. Now, for like a lot of people, I know that that's happened, for example, with coffee. I like to buy Kicking Horse coffee. They make good dark roasts. And once upon a time, you could wait for that to go on sale for $9.99 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
I used to grab like bags of it when it would go on for $9.99 a pound. Well, last week I got a couple of pounds of it at Loblaws for $15 a pound, and that was a good price.
Wow.
So that's changed quite a bit. I mean, so that's one of those things where you just have to accept, okay, you know, this has just gone up, and that's the way it is. And sometimes it goes full circle. I consider olive oil to be a staple. I use mm-hmm. a lot of olive oil in my cooking,
yeah.
And the price of olive oil really went up. Now it's coming back down again. I got a really great deal at Loblaws, extra virgin olive oil, President's Choice extra virgin olive oil, for basically $8 a liter.
Yeah, that's the thing that I've noticed over the years, and this is coming out of the pandemic, is that you can't shop at one place, can you? I mean,
you've got to move around.
Yeah, I mean, there's a chapter in the book about Sunrise Market. As a kid, my parents used to go there all the time, and then now I realize, that's the place to go when you want produce. Now, if you want olive oil, I'm sure they sell olive oil, but
they do.
You do have to go. You know, you can't just rely on one store like the No Frills or the Superstore or the Safeway or whatever.
You got to move around. I got a good deal on some olive oil that was near it. You know, its stamped expiry date. Which,
uh-huh.
You shouldn't worry too much about. I got that at Sunrise Market a little while ago, and then I got the stuff at Loblaws. Yeah, you know, Sunrise Market, it's essential to a lot of us in Vancouver. And now, of course, a lot of us are very choked because it's on the market. I was just talking to Jenny from Sunrise yesterday, and she emphasizes that they're, right now they're not listing the building. They're just listing the business.
Mm.
They want to sell the business, and I hope they're successful. I'm afraid it might be difficult for them to sell just the business, but I hope they can, because Sunrise Market is really essential for a lot of Vancouver shoppers. As I say in the book, I call it the secondhand vegetable store.
Yeah.
You know, they're getting stuff, warehouse stuff, you know, like excess shipments that someone else doesn't want, and so they can unload them at a very low price. It's And that's why, that's another thing about shopping, is you have to be flexible.
Mm.
And Sunrise is the perfect example. You go to Sunrise, you can't go to Sunrise with a list.
Mm.
You go to Sunrise and you see what the specials are. And then you plan around that. And that's, I think, a good strategy. Anytime you're shopping, is don't get stuck to a list. Look at what you can get that you can use. Like I say, don't buy things you can't use.
Yeah, yeah.
But look at what's available at a good price, and then plan accordingly.
How are you on the dates that we see on packages coming? There is a difference between best before and expiry, right?
Well, the real hardcore expiry dates, and this was something I just learned when I was reading the book. There's only like about two or three products that those are ever on.
Mm.
Best before is almost ubiquitous. I mean, most of the products you get, those are so-called expiry dates. What we call expiry dates are really best before dates. And they're just for the retailer. I mean, people think that it's going to go bad on that date. It's nonsense. But there are like two or three products that have hard expiry dates. One of them is infant formula.
Mm.
And another is like meal supplements intended for people who require meal supplements. And those things have hard expiry dates where you have to pull them off the shelves. But it's not because they're going to go bad. It's because the nutritional content is going to decline.
Mm.
And so they will no longer do the job that they're supposed to do. But there's really only two or three products, like I say, meal supplement products and infant formula that have hard expiry dates on them. Everything else is just kind of a suggestion to the retailer,
mm.
You know, sell it before this date. And when you see those 30 and 50% off stickers, honestly, my advice is grab them because you're still getting a good product.
Indeed. I think that's another psychological thing that we all have to get over, right? Because I guess we were trained that a date means something, but I mean, it really is just a guide, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think as I say in the book, I think one of the reasons we've got it into our heads that the dates are so meaningful is because we all know what happens to milk. Now, you know that the date on the milk carton, that's not a joke. You know, the milk is going to go sour. And so I think we transpose that idea to all these other products, and it doesn't really fit. Milk is a different kind of thing. Even yogurt isn't the same as milk. It may be a dairy product, but, you know, and yogurt doesn't have a tremendous shelf life. I'm not saying that you can just completely ignore the dates, but yogurt stays, you know, will stay edible for much longer than say a carton of milk will. But I think that's one of the reasons why we've gotten, you know, expiry dates or best before dates in our heads is because we all know that milk goes bad, and so we figure everything else does too. It doesn't really work the same way.
Well, we'll never forget the taste of sour milk, right?
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Talk in the book about renting versus owning, and that's something that I guess a lot of us in Vancouver talk about. Mm-hmm. You have no regrets about renting over the years, do you?
No, I don't. I really don't. Yeah. I wanted to be careful when I was writing about it in the book because, for one thing, I've never been an owner. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I can't speak authoritatively about what it's like to own a property. But all I can tell you is that I have been able to save a lot of money over the years, and I've never done anything but rent. And so I know that if you are diligent in your savings, renting can be a good way to go. I mean, the idea is that you buy a property and it appreciates in value, and that's your saving right there. And I suppose there's really a case to be made for that because, you know, if you buy a house or a condo, that becomes almost forced savings, right? I mean, mm-hmm. because you get equity and so you don't really need to be quite as disciplined perhaps in your saving because the property is saving for you. But there's downsides to it, too. Of course, there's maintenance costs and there's strata fees and all kinds of additional costs to ownership that I don't have. As a renter, I don't have any strata fees. I don't have any maintenance fees. If something goes wrong, the landlord fixes it.
Yeah.
And since I am pretty disciplined in my finances, that means that I have extra money, which, you know, if I was throwing it away on sports betting sites, then it wouldn't be much of an advantage to be a renter. Mm-hmm. But I'm not that kind of person. So that means it goes into the bank.
I bet you've been yelling at the TV a lot watching the Canucks.
Yeah, although after a while you give up. You give up, you stop yelling. You know, I was just thinking, okay, so we're now in the Olympic break, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of teams, of course, every team is going to see their points totals trending downward during the Olympic break. Not the Canucks.
No.
The Canucks will have a nice flat line going all the way through the Olympic break. They'll be doing just as well as they were last week. Boy, oh boy. I mean, I don't understand. I look at that team and I think, okay, they're bad, but I don't understand how they're that bad. They seem to have players who should be doing better.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, we're all committed to the tank now, so.
Indeed. You write so lovingly about living in the West End, and one can see how ideal it's been for your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Do you think if you'd lived anywhere else in the city that it would have been the same or different? Or worse, I should say?
I did live elsewhere in the city for many years. I lived in Mount Pleasant for about 16 years.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, things were the same. I don't think financially things were any different then for me. I just, you know, different parts of Vancouver have their advantages. One thing about being in Mount Pleasant is it was so central to everything.
Mm-hmm.
I could get on my bike and go here, there, and everywhere, and I could ride down into the West End. But a good friend of mine had this apartment in the West End, west of Denman, and when she got her dream job in New York, I was sitting at the table when she got the call that she was getting her dream job, and I suddenly went, oh, my God, I'm going to get your apartment, and I've been there ever since. And I just, you know, being beside Lost Lagoon, I just, I have to, it's one of those things where I've been here a long time, and of course you get used to where you are, and I really have to, on a regular basis, stop and say, remember, Steve, how much you wanted to be here. Don't forget how lucky you are to be where you are, because this is just where I wanted to be.
You write, as I said, so lovingly of where you live, and especially the Denman Place Mall, of the people that are there.
Yeah.
By the way, is there a thrift store in the Denman Place Mall?
There is. There is a small thrift store, yeah. It's runs to the benefit of a seniors center.
So yes, I've got to add that to the place to my list of places to go.
It's right beside the entrance to the Dollarama.
You capture people so well in the book. I mean, whether it's the landlord in the building that's the was it Joanne, the Rose Stitch proprietor,
Shad Amiri.
What is it about? When you encounter people, do you expect to write about them, or how does that relationship develop over the years? Say,
I don't, you know, because I mean, I'm not on, you know, on as a journalist all the time. You know, I'm not thinking, this will be good for a book. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people are like that. I tend to think of it sort of afterwards, and then I tend to think, oh, gee, I should ask more questions. But I, like, for example, Eshrad Amiri, who runs Rose Stitch in the Denman Place Mall, I've been going to her for years. And it was only when I was, you know, when I started writing this book that I realized, oh, yeah, repair, that's something that I should write about. And then I went and I talked to her, and that was a revelation.
Yeah.
Like, her story in that book blew my mind, and I had no idea. You know, I just started talking to her about, I thought I'd ask her about how she got started and everything, and then this story came out about her journey from Afghanistan to Iran and being married off in an arranged marriage when she was 14 years old, ending up in Germany and then Canada. You know, just an incredible story. I knew her for years, and I had no idea. She started telling me this story, and then I would come back two or three times, and I would just kind of surreptitiously be scribbling these notes in my notebook, so I made sure that I got her story right, you know, because there were so many different aspects to it. That's something when that happens, you think, wow, that's a gift.
Yeah.
As a writer, that's a gift when you meet somebody like that.
Yeah, again, it's part of a chapter where we talk about repairs to clothes, repairs to shoes, which I think a lot of us should consider instead of buying new things, especially if we buy expensive things that last longer, right?
That's right. If you know, and that is one thing I talked to, you know, James McKinnon, who's written many books, including The World Stops Shopping, and. You know, he talks about how sometimes, you know, frugality isn't always about buying the cheapest thing. If you're buying cheap clothes that are made in Bangladesh and they're throwaway, they're not worth repairing. You know, if you spend a little bit money and you get a little bit more money and you get something that's a quality item, and then when the time comes, you can repair it.
Yeah,
and it's going to last longer.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book. I mean, I read it, you know, sort of aspirationally. I mean, I need to be better with my money,
right.
And you've given me some advice as to how to do that. whether I succeed or not, that's another thing. But
right.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this view into your life and how you look at life, because I think there's great value there in terms of, especially when we live in such perilous times. This is a way to survive. I can't say how much I enjoyed the book. Congratulations and continue good luck with it, Steve. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you, Joe, and thanks for your support. You've been very supportive over the years, and I really appreciate it.
The book is called Cheapskate in Lotusland, The Philosophy and Practice of Living Well on a Small Budget. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Steve Burgess, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.